Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, an associate professor in classics and ancient history from La Trobe University. This is episode CCXXI, and part two of the Catiline Conspiracy. I'm calling this one an entire farrago. You see, the problem with conspiring against the Roman state and starting a civil war is that everyone assumes that you are involved in every underhanded activity found out by the Senate. This is what happened with Catiline. There was an earlier conspiracy, before the conspiracy, and in this episode we looked at the role he played in it, or didn't play in it, or did he? Here's Rhiannon Evans.
So what we're dealing with in this episode is something that might not have happened.
Yeah.
It's the possibly fictitious first Catilinian conspiracy, because the famous one, some people call the second conspiracy.
Mm.
All right, so the famous one is when Cicero was consul in 63 BCE. But possibly the kind of years leading up to that, 65 and 64, there was another conspiracy, a first conspiracy that he may have been involved in.
And is it that the events of this first supposed possible conspiracy get conflated with the second conspiracy and the accounts maybe just aren't as exact as to their timing and get the order of things mixed up? And
well, it's quite possible that because basically got an army together in 63 and there was a supposed attempt to kill Cicero and oust him, which I won't give it all away before we get there, that was then kind of retrojected back onto some conflict in the years 65 and 64 and that Catiline's name was wound up in it.
Oh, so he just gets implicated where he maybe.
Let me present the evidence and see what you think.
Context first. So this is 65, 64.
Yes. The first conspiracies, really, I would say all the evidence we have, because I think all of the other ancient evidence draws on it, is from a couple of chapters of Sallust. Now, this is chapters 18 and 19 of his Bellum Catilinae, the War of Catiline.
Yeah.
Most scholars think it's rubbish, but recently one, as I'll come to, has said, well, you know, why don't we take this seriously? So
okay,
let me present...
So this podcast episode is rubbish, but we might take it a little bit seriously.
No, I think it's interesting that okay. It's there anyway, even if everyone decides at the end of this that it is an invented conspiracy.
No, I just want to make sure the audience is invested to the appropriate level.
It's a little bit odd the way it appears in Sallust anyway, because in the chronological narrative, which he largely presents the chronology of the years leading up to and then the conspiracy, is actually a flashback. So he's been telling us in chapter 17 that we are in the consulship of Lucius Caesar and Gaius Figulus. So we're in 64 BCE now, when Catiline was sounding various people out about a possible conspiracy. Important to remember as background is that Pompey is out east fighting against Mithridates and he's been given amazing amounts of power and money to do this, right? Because I'll come back to that. So that's context. Part of that context is that it seems like a good time to overthrow the Roman state.
While everyone's distracted by what's going on.
Yeah, and also the most powerful man in Rome isn't there.
Yeah, yeah.
Fine, we're in 64 and then Sallust goes backwards. He says, now, even before that time, this is a direct quote from chapter 18, a few men had conspired against the government, and among them was Catiline. Of that affair, I shall give as true an account as I am able. Now, that's the phrase that people grab onto, as true an account as I am able. Mm-hmm. Does that mean I'm not really sure?
Not really sure on the details.
Yeah, or I don't really think this is true, but it's out there, so I'm going to grab the threads together and try and weave something up.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it does necessarily mean that, though, but see what we think. So he says, and I'm going to directly quote the whole of chapter 18, so, you know,
strap yourself
put your seatbelt on, yeah. And then I'll summarize chapter 19.
Yeah, okay.
So chapter 18. In the consulship of Lucius Tullus and Manius Lepidus, i.e. 66 BCE.
Okay, so a couple of years previous.
Yep. We've gone flashed back to a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
The consuls elect, all right, so the ones who are going to be consuls for 65.
Yeah.
They are Publius Autronius and Publius Sulla, were arraigned under the law against bribery and paid the penalties. And that means they can't be consuls.
Okay.
All right. A little later, Catiline was charged with extortion and prevented from standing for the consulship of 65. So in other words, they've got to have new elections.
Yeah.
Catiline tries to stand and Sallust says he was charged with extortion and prevented from standing of the consulship because he'd been able to announce his candidacy within the prescribed numbers of days. Now, this isn't right. Sallust mixed a few things up here. He was charged with extortion, but it was clearly later.
Yeah.
So already Sallust's on a bit of uneven ground, but I don't know whether that matters to the total story.
Mm-hmm.
There was at the same time a young noble called Gnaeus Piso, a man of the utmost recklessness, poor and given to intrigue. So the package of three makes you a conspirator in Sallust's eyes, who was being goaded on by the need of funds and an evil character to overthrow the government. So we've got these two consuls elect who've been told they can't take their magistracy, and this Piso who's just generally taken umbrage and needs money.
Mm.
He revealed his plans to Catiline and Autronius. Now, Autronius is one of the consuls who can't be a consul.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But not the other consul who can't be a consul. Instead of Sulla, Publius Sulla, we've got Catiline. This is what some people can't quite put together.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on here? He's not the aggrieved party, or maybe he is because he can't go in the rerun election. He says, about the 5th of December, they all began to make preparations to murder the consuls, that is the replacement consuls, Lucius Cotta and Lucius Torquatus, in the Capitol, which is a sacrilegious place to do it, by the way, the Temple of Jupiter, on the 1st of January, so when they take up their consulship. They then proposed that they themselves should seize the fasces, so these are the symbols of power, you know, the rods and axes.
The literal use this as a weapon.
Yeah, absolutely.
No symbolism there at all. Yeah.
And send Piso away with an army, he's the guy who needs money, to take possession of the two Spanish provinces. Now, just note here that Piso does go out to Spain after this.
Okay, so all right.
If we're kind of creating some kind of made-up conspiracy, then we've woven some facts in there.
Yeah.
Upon the discovery of their plot, so they don't get away with it, they postponed their murderous designs until the 5th of February.
So the plot is discovered, but they'll just put it off.
Yeah. You're starting to pull away at these threads, aren't you? At that time, they plotted the destruction not merely of the consuls, but of many of the senators. And had Catiline not been over hasty in giving the signal to his accomplices in front of the Senate House, on that day, the most dreadful crime since the founding of the city of Rome would have been perpetrated. It's pretty melodramatic.
Mm.
But because the armed conspirators had not yet assembled in sufficient numbers, the affair came to nothing.
Okay. So it ran out of steam if it did happen.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you're going to give Sallust or his sources some credit, then maybe what you were objecting to, which I think is reasonable, that it was discovered, so they just postponed it, is maybe some of the lower level conspirators got found out, or there was just rumors of a conspiracy, so they thought, oh, they might be too alert on the 1st of January. Let's wait till they've been in place for 6 weeks and then we'll do it and we'll get rid of the whole Senate as well.
Mm.
What I like in this chapter is not even really to do with the possible conspiracy, but that it would have been the worst crime since the founding of the city of Rome.
That's a very long list, though, of possible crimes that are worse than this, I'm sure.
I think it's referring to Romulus killing Remus.
Yeah, I know that.
Fratricide was the worst possible crime.
But you think there are worse ones in between? Have you met the Gracchi? You know?
Been a lot of murders, yeah. So that conspiracy was a kind of proto-conspiracy that didn't get off the ground.
Mm.
That's the one that some people don't believe. Just to finish that story off, to get back to the present, and we will have another think about the evidence or who's for and who's against the proto-conspiracy. In chapter 19, we get a long narrative of Piso going off to Spain and being murdered. And who might have done that? Sallust says that the Senate had sent him to Spain to get rid of a corrupt politician. But he then suggests that maybe the local Spaniards thought he was too harsh and murdered him, but nobody really knows if that's true. So there's a lot of doubt around this story about even who killed Piso.
Mm.
And what he also suggests, which comes back to what I was saying about Pompey, is that one reason they sent him off to Spain was to counter the power of Pompey, that they wanted someone out west with power while Pompey's out east with power.
Yeah, yeah.
And certainly what Barbara Levick, who's a really important scholar on Catiline, keep stressing is just how powerful Pompey is and how the rest of the Senate, or a lot of the senators, might have resented that. that means they're kind of alive to risks or possible ways in which their power might be drawn down, because we've got these people who are becoming too powerful, and Pompey's really the first of them that is kind of taking hold of the imagination. Mm. And that means that they're alert to possible conspiracies, which means maybe this one is made up. And they even maybe build up Catiline to be more of a risk than he was.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of general atmosphere of fear, I guess. Now, if you want some of the quotes, Levick, who I just mentioned, Barbara Levick, called the thing an entire farrago.
What's farrago?
I like that. It's a Latin word meaning porridge. It's been called a phantom. It's been called a myth. And by Ronald Syme, who is a great, originally New Zealand scholar of the Roman Republic, a tissue of improbabilities. But, you know, Woodman, Tony Woodman, who is himself a great scholar of Roman historiography, has recently argued, just in 2021, that there is no reason why we should not take Sallust at his word.
Okay.
And he works through it and argues for this passage. So, okay. I don't know. I like Sallust and I like Woodman's work, so maybe it did happen.
Okay. Part of me kind of goes, okay, maybe some of these events did happen, like Piso going off to Spain. Mm. And maybe, you know, some people were caught on a conspiracy and we're just going to associate Catiline's name with these events because he's a rotter and he's around. And of course he'd be involved. And he had to have learnt his trick somewhere.
Yeah.
And if somebody's going to kill somebody for politics, Catiline's going to be there. Yeah.
You're very much in line with Barbara Levick here, so you're in good company.
Yeah.
She's arguing, which I also find persuasive, pretty much what you were saying, that if there is a crime happening, it's good to attach Catiline's name to it. And in a way, we work backwards because one of the people who says this about Catiline is Cicero.
Mm.
And Cicero says it about him when he's claiming that Catiline is now conspiring against him while he's consul.
Yeah.
So he says, oh, well, we remember that time when, you know, the two consuls had been ousted and they tried to come back. And he attaches Catiline's name to that. But of course, it's absolutely in his interests at that point to paint Catiline as a career criminal.
Yes, everything gets brought up and attached to Catiline at that point.
The other reason, if I can be allowed to just talk about obscure authors for a moment, Asconius, who wrote a commentary on Cicero's work, and Cicero wrote that work on standing for election, which we don't have, but we've got Asconius's commentary. He says that there was a general belief that Catiline and Gnaeus Piso had formed a conspiracy to murder the Senate a year before. And people grab hold of that word, general belief, the word opinio in Latin, and say, oh, well, he doesn't believe it either.
Okay.
So it's little things like that.
Yeah, that's inferring a lot from...
It is inferring a lot. Yeah, quite
from,
right.
From one word of a text, you know, that can be translated a myriad of ways.
One notable exception, or at least different version of this, is that Suetonius, because he's writing a biography of Julius Caesar, says that the suspicion fell on Sulla, who's that other ousted consul who never got to be consul, Crassus, and Caesar.
Okay.
So that they were responsible for this unsuccessful conspiracy. And he doesn't mention Catiline.
No, all right.
And he doesn't mention the other not consul. Rumor of a conspiracy and you attach the name you want to it.
Sure. Okay. All right. I get what you're saying there.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. We can't be very certain about that. I end up sitting on the fence, I'm afraid, which is my want. I think it's interesting that Woodman has come out in defense of it, given that the weight of Roman scholarship has said, oh, it didn't happen. Didn't happen.
Okay. Made up. But regardless, it's still referred to as the first Catalan conspiracy.
Yeah. If we refer to it at all, we don't have to refer to the next one as the second.
Yeah.
It just is the conspiracy. It's the one we are going to be concentrating on.
Just big old quotation marks around that one.
What we're going to do now is what leads up to it, when Catiline definitely did campaign for the consulship of 63 and how he campaigned.
Okay, so close brackets, paragraph, paragraph, paragraph. Let's talk about the Catalan conspiracy now.
The conspiracy. You could put the emphasis on the.
Why are you using capital letters in the episode name? What leads up to it?
Okay. Sorry to say, some of this is contested too.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically, Catiline clearly expresses the desire to be the consul for 63. And it's going to be a three-way race with him and Cicero and Antonius. Mm-hmm. All right. So remember, we did mention in the last episode that Cicero had thought about joining ranks with Catiline.
Yes.
Back in 65, we have evidence from his letters that he was thinking about trying to sort of edge Antonius out by joining with Catiline, but he decided against it.
Mm.
What we don't know, and what we get from some sources, is that Catiline was already gathering arms and supporters. In other words, already thinking, if I lose, I've got this as my backup. Sallust says that he was, in chapter 17 of the Catilinarian War. He casts his intentions as kind of conspiratorial or criminal right from the start. But this could be just with the hindsight of knowing that he failed in the consulship and then there was a battle.
I can totally believe him already trying to set the narrative of, if I lost, it's because it's been stolen from me.
Yep, I'd agree.
Yeah.
Barbara Levick says, and this is why I really emphasized so much this fear of Pompey and kind of general fear, that there is an atmosphere of the top senators, the optimates, those senators who really want to preserve the power of the Senate and not dilute it at all and not give way to any kind of call for land rights or changes in the composition of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
They've got this fear of opposition and violence, and they worry that, I mean, ironically, given that Pompey ends up fighting for the Senate against Caesar, who's the more kind of popular or popularis candidate, in this period, Pompey is seen as someone who might not be relied upon to support the Senate. Mm. That sometimes he calls out to the people and makes those kind of demagogue-like speeches. So what they think is happening is that Cicero gets the backing of those optimates to defeat this threat from those popular candidates. One of the people who's seen as a popular candidate is Catiline. It's all a bit topsy-turvy if you wanted strict kind of columns of who's backing who here.
Mm.
All right, we don't really get that. This is not party politics. It's not even party politics where people sometimes change sides. We don't really have an optimates and a populares party. And Cicero would not, you would think, be a natural supporter of the traditional families of the Senate, because he hasn't had any relative who has been consul or even senator before.
Yeah.
He's come from nowhere in a way, very rich nowhere, but still, he's a new man, an homo novus. Whereas Caesar comes from exactly the right kind of family, high patrician family. Cicero then seems to get in on the backing of these people, and then he becomes that kind of staunch conservative, or maybe he always was, who wants to protect the Senate. So Levick's saying this is kind of the bargain that Cicero strikes for the consulship, and a way that the more conservative elements in the Senate want to, again, counteract Pompey's power if they can get someone like Cicero who will stand up for them, because he is the best speaker in Rome at that time, and that commands a lot of power in itself. They see Catiline as very much a demagogue, calling on the people, you know, calling on their grievances, that they should back him because of those grievances. And the optimates hate that, so they really want to keep Catiline out.
So is it like he's playing fear politics or something like that?
Yeah, that's how they see it. Absolutely playing on the way people feel they've been left out, left behind.
Yeah, yeah.
And that he will help them out, therefore they should vote for him.
Okay, so it's all grievances then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sallust then depicts the campaign's aim as to overthrow the state even if Catiline wins the consulship. So it's not just, and if I lose, look, I've got this army out here that'll rise up for me.
Mm.
It's even if he wins the consulship, he's going to use that consulship to overthrow the state. This is strange in a way, because if you get to be consul, you have a lot of power anyway.
Yeah.
But what Sallust has is in chapter 17, he has Catiline gather together other senators and elites, the ones who are in real strife, as Sallust says, the neediest and most reckless of his acquaintance. And he tempts them with riches and luxury. He says, you know, you back me and I will give you all of this easy life and you'll get all of these luxury goods and I'll pay you all this money. Basically, he's bribing them.
Yeah, yeah.
Sallust, I would say, is a hypocrite here, because you could easily argue that Julius Caesar did the same thing, and Sallust's a huge backer of Caesar. So there you go. Anyway, he's trying to show us Catiline in a bad light at pretty much every turn.
Yeah.
But this idea of the needy and the reckless, a lot of Roman authors thought was one of the reasons for the downfall of the Republic, that you've got all of these very powerful men from rich families, but they've spent all that money or their families lost it. So they've got position and authority without having the means to kind of maintain that position.
Yeah.
I think that's a way for them to try and explain why they're willing to talk to the masses.
Mm.
Otherwise, why would you bother?
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people implicate Crassus as well. I mentioned Crassus before as at least by Suetonius being implicated in the must do the scare quotes first conspiracy. If they think he's involved, it's a way of getting back at Pompey, his hated rival, he's called here, because Pompey is so powerful. Commentators point out, however, that this doesn't really work. It's anachronistic because any conspiracy would come after Catiline loses the election of 64. Why would you have a conspiracy set in motion if you're trying to be consul? Why would you want both of those things to happen? You'd be overthrowing yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
So that makes us question Sallust's account, I must admit. What instead seems to be happening is that we're getting this picture. It's a little bit like Plutarch often does when we've talked about any of Plutarch's biographies, that he gives a complete picture of someone's character. And if that doesn't always fit the facts, then they might get exaggerated or twisted in some way.
Mm.
I think that might be what's happening here with Sallust, that he just wants to show Catiline as a bit of a wrecker from the start. That's a very institutional thing to do.
Mm.
If you think the institutions should all be thrown out, why would you stand to be one of the magistrates in that institution?
Conspiring and bribery and whatever else is being implicated aside, there is general campaigning going on.
Mm.
At this point,
they could be part of the same thing.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
They don't need to be completely divorced from each other as well. But so what do we know about Catiline's, you know, vote for me kind of shtick?
Sallust gives us a picture of him as appealing to people's sense of lost freedom.
Mm.
And he gives us a speech, which, you know, Sallust would have written, but it might encompass what he knows of some of how Catiline was trying to appear to the public. So I'll just read a section of chapter 20. We really had a deep dive into a few chapters of Sallust.
Yeah.
But I think this is really good as a way of at least showing us how Sallust portrays Catiline.
Yeah.
And perhaps how he was actually acting himself. The speech that Sallust gives us, that Catiline gives as part of his electioneering, is not a typical electioneering speech in some ways, because it's not to the vast masses or even...
So he's not standing in the forum on the rostrum or anything like that?
No, he actually says it's in a private room and it's to those people he's conspiring with, because this is part of Sallust building up. There's a conspiracy But it is also an electioneering type speech, because it's using the buzzwords of libertas, you know, liberty, gloria, honor, glory, and kind of appealing to an idea that we don't have access to these anymore. Vote for me or support me and we'll get it back.
Okay.
So he's using that good old Rome used to be greater, or we used to have more access to its greatness and luxuries and riches that were available, and now that's being taken away from us. So there's grievances.
All right, so make Rome great again. Mm. Off you go.
This is how we do it. He says, "My resolution is fired more and more every day when I consider what the condition of our lives will be if we do not take the initiative to set ourselves free." So he's implying that they are in servitude.
Mm-hmm.
"For ever since the state fell under the jurisdiction and sway of a few powerful men," he's vague, but you know, I guess it's people like Pompey.
Yeah.
"It is always to them that kings and petty rulers, nations and peoples pay taxes." We're not getting that money. "All the rest of us, energetic, good, nobles as well as nobodies."
Fine people.
"Have been a common herd without influence, without prestige, subservient to those to whom, if the state were healthy, we would be an object of dread." So this is a great speech that Sallust reconstructed or invented, that he wants people to fear him.
Yeah.
He's implying.
Yeah.
And to fear not just him, but his little gang. "Accordingly, all influence, power, office, and wealth are in their hands, wherever those individuals wish them to be. To us, they have left the threads of prosecution, defeats in elections, convictions, and poverty. How much longer still will you put up with this, O bravest of men?" Now, that part at the end is clearly a callback to Cicero's first speech against Catiline, which he starts with, how long do you intend to test our patience, Catiline? Because Catiline's still sitting there and he's telling him he should be out. He should be gone because he's not worthy of being in the Senate.
Mm.
And he goes on, I've left a little bit out of chapter 20, but continues, what mortal who has a manly disposition can endure that our opponents have a surfeit of riches to squander in building upon the sea and levelling mountains, while we lack the private means to buy the bare necessities of life, which you can be sure they did not, because their idea of what poverty was would not have been what the vast majority of Romans experienced. But when he talks about building upon the sea, I think he, or at least Sallust's version of him, is referring to Lucullus, who had been a very successful general and politician around the time of Sulla and Marius and been involved in those civil wars, who had then just given it all up and retired into luxury and extravagance and had actually built extensions from his villas out to the sea over in at Naples.
Oh, nice.
And had had these fish ponds. Do you remember that the Romans were kind of obsessed with the expenses around fish ponds and showing that showed how extravagant people were if they had, I don't know, a fish worth 100,000 sesterces in their fish pond.
So it's kind of all
pointing in that direction. We've got all these people living in this extreme luxury, and why have I not got a piece of this?
Jealousy about wealth by the looks of this, power and wealth.
And it goes on and on and on, talking about debt, talking about, I want to put this right as consul. At the end of the speech, he says, I shall carry out as consul these very enterprises together with you, unless by chance my mind is self-deluded and you are more ready to be slaves than to rule. So that's the alternative. Either you're going to be slaves or you rise up with me.
Yeah.
This is what I've been talking about, where Sallust really gives us this idea of Catiline as somebody who is preparing conspiracy, even if he is consul.
Mm. Okay. I mean, that seemed a bit rambling even just for Sallust. So
I didn't even give you all of it.
I hate to think what the real speech was like. That must
there may have been no real speech.
Some tangents about wind farms and everything going on there. What's going on? So this amounts to Catiline really making a lot of promises to get allies.
Yeah.
This isn't about winning elections at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say you need to win over important people to win an election at all.
Mm.
And he's appealing to those who are in debt. He's going to promise the cancellation of debts, which came up every now and again.
Yeah.
He's promising the magistracies and priesthoods. And look, I imagine this went on at some kind of low-key level with every election, not just one where you were intending to mount a conspiracy, that you got allies by saying, you know, I'll make sure you get this priesthood not just you, obviously all the clients that you've got and you're a patron of to vote for me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, even more so in this time, I'm sure.
He also calls for the execution of the rich, proscriptions.
Wow.
You would not say that in public because the memory of the bloodshed under the regime of Sulla, Marius as well, had carried out proscriptions, which is why it's so weird that when we get to the next civil war, outside of the scope of 63 BCE, we're going to have proscriptions again with Octavian, a couple of civil wars later, actually, the memory would have been alive.
If Catiline had his way and it spun out even more, that proscriptions would have come up at some point.
Certainly this version of Catiline that Sallust gives us. And that is our main source for Catiline. In a way, what Sallust says, though, is irrational because he says he's got allies in Spain. He's got Piso in Spain.
Mm.
But Piso is already dead and Sallust has told us that.
Maybe Catiline forgot.
Maybe he did.
Maybe it's just more convenient for him to remember him as being alive for the sake of this argument and hope that nobody else notices in the room.
And he says, it'll be fine because I'll have Gaius Antonius as my colleague as consul. He's not going to do anything.
Mm.
Ironic, because as Sallust well knows, it's going to be Gaius Antonius and Cicero who will be consuls in 63.
Mm.
Very much as Catiline is promising in this speech, Cicero will manage to keep Antonius in check by saying, you can have a really good province next year.
Yeah. So
just do what I want you to do.
That's right. Yeah. You be the puppet for the year.
Pretty much. And we finish off this particular chapter of Catiline's attempt to grab power, where Sallust tells us that these people basically Catiline and his cronies make an oath together, and an oath where they drink human blood mixed with wine. So we get some sort of weird gothic frisson going on here. It makes it absolutely outrageous, and that shows their allegiance to each other, that they're drinking human blood.
Is it the Roman equivalent of spitting on your hand and doing a handshake?
It might have been made up to make Cicero's later actions look less outrageous, that he was dealing with real lunatic fringe here and he had to do what he did. I'm not going to tell you what he did, yeah. But when we come to it, remember this moment.
Yes. Okay. All right.
So really, everything that I've spoken about in this episode is on a little bit of shaky ground, but I wanted to go through it anyway, partly to show the way that Sallust is setting up Catiline, but also just as a demonstration of how we have to read between the lines of our ancient sources sometimes, and that doing that might mean that we get conflicting accounts coming from different scholars.
Yeah.
But we are moving on to firmer ground with the actual year of 63 BCE and the events of that year. There'll still be little arguments about what Cicero's exaggerating, because as we'll see, it's in his interests to exaggerate what Catiline's up to.
Mm.
But we will now get to a conspiracy we don't have to put quote marks around, and we'll see how the Roman Republic deals with a real shake that isn't about a civil war. It's not about two factions within the state. It's possibly about someone trying to entirely overturn the state, a violent precursor to what Octavian eventually does. And of course, Octavian comes to power by violence too, but it's not by going in and murdering everyone in the Senate, it's through civil war.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of a foreshadowing of that conflict that we've got between those who want to get to power the traditional way and those who are prepared to break the institutions of Rome to get there.
That was Rhiannon Evans, an associate professor in classics and ancient history from La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it, send a link to your friends, or leave a review. You can follow Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and we are on what is left of Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. You can also get in touch by sending us an email, emperorspodcast@gmail.com. Emperors of Rome is produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. In the next episode, we'll take a look at how Catiline's plot was discovered and foiled. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.